Welcome to Money Markets and Masterminds, a Citywire South Africa podcast that delves into the intricate world of finance, investment, and strategic decision making. If you're a fund selector or an independent financial advisor or an institutional investor looking for insights, analysis, and expert opinions to enhance your perspective, you're in the right place here with me, editor Ruwan Uester. And today's episode is a first for us. We're joined by not one but two guests as we take a deep dive into the dynamics of China's global investment influence and what that means for South African capital allocators. We're heading east, both economically and metaphorically. In late March, I had the opportunity to visit China and Hong Kong as a guest of Prescura, a well-known local investment advisory firm, and Altvest, an upcoming South African asset manager. What I saw and heard there gave me a front row seat to how China is positioning itself globally through long-term investment strategy, capital alignment, and targeted sector development, especially in the tech space. In this episode, we'll unpack what South African investors can learn from that approach and whether now is the right time to place smart bets on China's venture capital tech sector, especially as US President Donald Trump stirs geopolitical tension and global big tech faces a potential valuation reset. Joining me is my two guests with deep expertise in the China's markets and capital allocation. In general is Akshay Karan, CEO of Altvest, and Jared Glansbeek, founder and director at Rescura. Gents, welcome to the show.
Hi, Ron. Akshay.
Hi. Hi, guys. And hi to everyone listening. Thanks for having me.
We've been watching the trade tensions between the US and China escalate again, especially with Trump hinting at more aggressive tariffs in a potential second term. And who knows what is going to happen tomorrow. But as media reports are implying, China may actually hold more cards in the geopolitical standoff than many assume. Jared, from a macro and institutional perspective, do you think investors underestimate the level of planning and patience that underpins China's economic strategy?
Hi, Ron. So what's interesting, I don't know if you saw that joke about who holds the cards, and then China says, we made the cards, so, because they're obviously involved in that kind of industry. But what's been interesting for me is if you look at institutional investors around the world, everybody, because of geopolitics for the last, 10 years odd, has steadily taken out all the investments out of China and actually written China off. So what's interesting is there's this gap, there's this knowledge gap of China, which is really developed. And it's funny, you know, when all of this started, I said to my team, this is not, there's the geopolitical issue, but it's not really, the test is going to be who understands the detail, the minutia, because there's the big picture of tariffs, etc. But then what does that imply? And the test between the US and China is, who understands that detail? So I actually think that the issue is less macro, which people think, but I think it's actually quite micro. And remember one thing: China have had 5 years to strategize, to put something together on how they're dealing with this, and you can see that coming through very, very clearly in their reactions. So it's going to be interesting where this goes. We'll have to see.
In my recent Citywire South Africa interview with your head of research in the region, Robin Yu, he said now is the time for institutional investors to reassess their Chinese exposure. What specific signals are you seeing that suggest that this is a timely opportunity rather than a value trap?
So there are two things. I mean, as you know, when you invest, it's always what is in the price. So I just want to discuss that a little bit. Obviously, there are geopolitical tensions, and this has really driven valuation in China to levels where actually they got down. I mean, China underperformed the US by 60%. What was interesting is if you compared emerging markets to developed markets, emerging markets have suffered relative to developed markets for a long time. But interestingly enough, emerging markets excluding China performed in line with developed markets excluding the US. It's a phenomenal thing. So the big dislocation is China versus US. And we can see that they got to the level that China underperformed the US by 60%. Now, that says a lot is in the price. And the reason I raise that is because the US accounts for less than 2.5%. The US trade of 2.5% of GDP in China. So whatever you decide, excluding things like stimulus, etc., you've got to say, well, how big will the impact? Now, if they can corral other people into this, it could be quite big, but The bottom line is valuations have got a lot built in. And then you've got to say, is China in that weaker position relative to this? So for me, the catalyst was, and you've seen it, I mean, year to date, China's outperformed the US. So from suffering hugely and through the last month, which is really telling on tariffs, you've seen China A shares underperform a little bit. China A shares actually do quite well. So we'll see where that goes. But I for me, valuation and not understanding what is in the price has been the catalyst, and those have fundamentally turned.
Jarrett, policy unpredictability remains a concern for many allocators, especially from the US. How do you weigh those risks against the structural reforms and signs of recovery in China's tech and consumer sectors?
So what's been interesting is whether, you know, is viewing this as a catalyst. So the Chinese policy has had some tough turns and lessons, and they really got to the space where I think the Chinese politerati now understand how silly it is to marginalize business. So there's Chinese policy and the lessons they've learned. I mean, from COVID, if you recall, we've seen it implicit to our NASPAS price. Now, for those of you that don't understand, NASPAS obviously bought a company called Tencent. It's kind of the Facebook, if you like, of China. And they bought it for $30 million in 2002, and $30 million. And today it's worth, you know, circa 160 billion. So it's there's been a huge gain. But since COVID, policy has been really one reflective of social norms, looking at things like demographics, what are people paid, fairness, social awareness. So there have been a lot of things where they've really tried to knuckle down. But what you've seen is very strong signals in the last little while that have changed that. I would suggest in your question, Ron, the issue is not so much the lessons that China has learned, but the policy uncertainty that's coming from the US. Because I think the US is in a very tough position. You've seen market values really reduce substantially because it's not clear if they do understand what they're doing. So the bigger policy uncertainty is going to come from the US. And we'll have to see where that goes. Now, the last thing I want to say is most people, if you look at portfolios, say US wins, China loses. And that really is going to be the question that plays out in everybody's portfolios.
Jarrett, you've described China as a missed price opportunity in inverted commas. Can you unpack what that looks like, whether it's a broad-based or a more concentrated in specific sectors or asset classes?
So for me, the mispricing is purely how prices, I mean, at one stage, the PEs for what they're worth of China were down to really almost a third, certainly below half that of the US. Now, it has a 1.4 billion population they can access and sell products to. And yet we had this huge dislocation, everybody in the West taking their assets out, creating sells. I mean, even the only real US investment left is ADRs in the US and only a portion of that. So you've had capital flight. It's created a big downswing in prices, and it really comes down to valuation. We can see that, by the way, even in our own market, where you can see NASPAS is continually hit, and the price, you know, it's trading at a 60% discount to its underlying NAV. So double whammy. You've got Tencent cheaper than its peers offshore, trading at and tech trading at a discount of up to 50% relative to the offshore markets. And then you've got NASPAS on an NAV basis trading at a 60% discount. It's actually, you know, it's quite insane. So the mispricing is purely everything is counted against China. It's in the price. And is that where things settle? Is that a fair price given up until a month ago, the extreme pricing of the Mag 7 and really what has driven world markets? So I would just say is when you play a game like that, and it comes from people not owning China and then valuations of China being super low, you really got to say, is that the way the answer goes given geopolitics and the dislocation of the US and China? So for me, it's that's been the fundamental issue.
Jared, how should South African pension funds be thinking about capturing that opportunity? Is there merit in a more passive multi-asset approach, or is active allocation still the best way in? And while you're at it, perhaps you can just enlighten my listeners about Rescure's actual exposure in the region.
I think the first thing is, when we see what makes sense, one would never actually say passive in China makes sense. Firstly, managers outperform. So active management over time is better than passive management. It's very clear benchmarks include a whole lot of SAEs. So that's almost like including our SAEs in the SWIX or the South African benchmarks. It just doesn't make a whole lot of sense given state intervention. So if you follow that, you're going to get into trouble. So it means you need active. But I would suggest the bigger, there are two areas. One, as you asked before, are there sectors? I think the entire Chinese market is cheap. But two sides. The one side is listed assets, and the other side is things like venture capital. Now, with where geopolitics goes, you're going to be in the place where actually the US and China need to get tech right. You have to get tech right, and so both markets will be pushing that. Cheap capital will be allowed, and if you take your capital and put that with those markets, I think you will do extremely well. What I find quite interesting is, let's just say if you look at what tech companies do, or even motor car companies do, you're in the place where Chinese factories produce cars every 60 seconds. I mean, it's phenomenal. Every 60 seconds. So you want to be in places of high growth, linked into the market, less geopolitical risk. So I would just suggest that if you're going to go completely passive, that would be a problem. So we when we look at our exposures, we obviously have MassPass, and that there, if you think of portfolios at circa 40% local equity, 35 to 45% local equity, maybe 10 to 15% of that is a MassPass. That's the first bit of exposure. And then we've got direct exposure of around about 5% in China. And that's through a variety of ways, both listed and venture capital, because these two areas of investing are so critical to extracting performance out of that market. We do, however, just to say, we also have US investments. This is not a one-horse game. You need to make sure that you're looking at both of these in your portfolio and mixing that well. If these economies become dislocated, which all intent is pointing to, you want to have both of these in your portfolio rather than one.
Before we go over to Akshay, one last question. In some of our previous conversations, you also mentioned benchmark bias and the tendency to default to developed market exposure like the US. Is South Africa's institutional space still stuck in a home country mindset when it comes to global investing?
So I would suggest we're stuck in a developed market index, which is really the MSCI. And most of these policies at institutional investors in SA were put together kind of 10, 15 years ago, and the US exposure was half. Now the US exposure counts for almost 70, 75% of that exposure. You've got less of Japan, UK, Europe, etc. And that's a pretty tough place to start from. It also, when you look at, and institutions are like that, got very little emerging market, very little China. You must recognize that you're saying two things. One, I have zero emerging markets outside of South Africa and the underlying holdings of South Africa. And so I believe in all of this decoupling, etc., the US will win. I find that binary approach very hard. And in fact, it's not even developed markets will win. It's US will win, because it just overwhelms portfolios. And I think people are starting to understand that. Certainly the events of the last 2 months push everyone there. So what the position we're in is, in our local portfolios, we have China, we've got other emerging markets, and we've got a global portfolio in our local portfolio, gold mines, etc. So 60% of our market, our local market, is offshore anyway, which is a poorly constructed offshore portfolio. Then offshore, we develop markets, and 75% of that is, let's just say, and it could possibly be higher than that, in fact, I think the number is actually 67, but that's a huge proportion that's in the US. So we're making some very clear statements. Great for looking at past performance, but you, as of today, your entire portfolio comprises the views you have today. And so you're making these statements going forward. And I think that's a fairly, that rabbit hole is very, very weak, needs to be reevaluated. And ultimately, we need to start saying, okay, developed markets is one thing. We've got to upweight those markets outside of the US. And certainly the questions around treasuries and safe haven status will do that. And so upweight Japan, et cetera. And maybe our good active managers in developed markets have already done a lot of that. So that will be good. But we've got to get to a place where you are having reasonable exposure in both areas, because your current strategy is saying there is only one winner because of views established 20 years ago.
Let's go over to you, Akshay. AltVest's Oriental Venture Capital Fund, which is still awaiting approval from the regulator, is offering local investors a window into early-stage Chinese tech. That's not an easy market to break into. What gave you the confidence to take that leap now?
Thanks, Ruan. I think it's there's three major drivers of us doing what we're doing. The first is the size of the opportunity, and I think Jared articulated that fantastic. This is an incredible market opportunity, but it's also a very important diversification opportunity for any investor to have a meaningful say in this emerging economy that could very well grow into becoming the largest economy in the world, with the most advanced technology behind it. So the first is the size of the opportunity. The second is the right partners. I think we've been extremely impressed by the expertise of the Rescura Invest team, both on the ground but also across the organization. And that gives us a lot of comfort, because when pursuing something like this, looking at investing in a foreign market, a market that most of us may not understand as well as we'd like, you need to back expertise. You have to back the people that know what they are doing. And we get a lot of comfort from that. And the last is, of course, the right structure. You know, you can have a great opportunity, you can have the right people, but if the structure is not right, you'll never extract the value you need to. And so it's taken us some time to land on a structure that we're really proud of, one that is uniquely South African, with a South African entry point that offers all the benefits of being listed and regulated in our local market to local investors, but also benefits from the best-in-class global structures for channeling capital in and out of China. And so all three of those came together, and that's where we are now.
You describe the strategy as a high conviction call, and you're investing in sectors like artificial intelligence, health tech, and consumer platforms, some of which will define the next decade, as I saw in our recent trip. But what types of companies or asset managers are you backing, and how do you perform due diligence from here in South Africa?
Yeah, so I think ultimately, you know, investing is a professional service. It's like a dentist or a doctor or even a plumber. And in any professional service, you have to pay for quality. And so a big, big focus for us is getting comfortable that we are backing quality. We're backing the managers that have three things. They have expertise, so they know what they're doing. They know their market. The second is they have strategic focus. So they are very clear about where their opportunity space lies, what they're focusing on. And in this market, it gets incredibly granular. It goes as granular as, you know, medical tech only, with a view towards selling to pharmaceutical companies. Deep tech, where you're actually supporting enablers of technology. So the fund managers in this space are as focused as that. And then, of course, the last point is track record. You know, are they able to turn their expertise and their focus into measurable returns over a period of time? And so those are the three things that are important to us from a due diligence perspective. Beyond that, I think when you actually kick the tires on the specific underlying companies, you can't help but get excited when you see the transformative impact these businesses can have from anything from autonomous driving to, you know, health tech. These are technologies that will shape the future of human development. And we can't, I don't think we can afford to not be involved in this. We have to have a piece of it because ultimately it's going to impact our lives. AI is already a great example of it.
Altvest advocates democratizing access to investment markets, but the Chinese VC space can be capital intensive and complex. How do you balance accessibility with institutional grade execution?
I think that is true of any venture capital investment. Venture capital, by its very nature, is capital intensive and complex. And what I'll add to that is it's risky. For us, the secret sauce is our listed structure. Our ability to turn investments that operate through complex structures with multi-million rand buy-ins and complex legals into a simple listed investment instrument that is regulated on a stock exchange that an investor can easily understand and importantly purchase at an affordable entry point. That is our value add here. That is how we balance accessibility with institutional grade execution, by focusing on making this robust enough to pass the rigor of our listed markets, but offer as much of that upside that these complex institutional focus structures offer. So that's really where our unique value add lies, in cutting through that complexity and getting to a point where an ordinary South African or an institution that doesn't necessarily have the investment capacity or the risk appetite to invest in these assets at the quantums you would need to, can do so through our structure and still feel comfortable that it's fully regulated and licensed and it meets the rigor of the, you know, of our capital markets.
Do you think South African investors are ready for this type of global exposure, or are we still too focused on local listed equity and bricks and mortar property?
We're absolutely ready. And I think we've been ready for a long time. You know, Jared mentioned Naspers, which is one of the single greatest drivers of equity value in the South African economy over the last few decades. And that was driven by Chinese VC, ultimately. Yes, that they did on balance sheet. South Africans have a unique curiosity in risky assets. We see it in the interest and the inflows into Chinese tech. We see it, into US tech. We see it in the interest in things like crypto. Our investors want access to emerging technology. They want access to a global perspective. And so all we're doing is we want to give them access to another option. And I think, as Jared very rightly mentioned, with the important caveat that we view this as fitting into a balanced risk-adjusted portfolio. This is not, in our view, the 100% play. This is the smaller play within your risky component of your portfolio that you want, so that you don't have an inherent concentration risk on the US economy in a world where there is so much geopolitical uncertainty. We want to give that alternative to investors. And I think beyond that, we want to give something exciting to investors, particularly the retail investors who are excited about things like AI and autonomous vehicles and health tech. And so, and want to allocate a little bit of capital to that. Now they'll hopefully have the opportunity to do so.
Before we wrap up today's episode, this question is aimed at both my guests. If there's one lesson from China's economic playbook that South African fund managers should borrow today, what would that be? Jared, let's start with you.
I think I'd like to just actually talk, I mean, just adjust your question slightly and talk about institutional investors, what they can learn. And we've got the track record. I mean, actually, I mentioned Naspers. Let's just understand that. We have a market where the JSE is 20% bigger because of a deal done at 30 million in 2002. And that grew to 160 billion. I mean, that's enormous. But we did not have the capacity in South Africa to do that. There's a big population, etc. But it changed the lives of every South African who has a pension holding. When we go to China all the time, they're producing cars every 60 seconds. What that means is, can South Africans really compete? And I think the lesson there is, and you've got it with NASPAS, we need to take our portfolios and make sure that they are invested in South Africa to make South Africa great. But outside of that, we have this wonderful market where, as a per capita, in terms of pension, I know there are lots of arguments that a lot of people don't have enough pension, but our pension funds assets are actually quite big, bigger than most emerging markets. But to take that and not only invest in South Africa, but invest in the best companies elsewhere in the world, grows that pot. It grows the pension pot. And every investor should think about doing this. If we can, in this vehicle, find those things which can create 20% more assets on a very small investment in an overall portfolio, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5%, that there is what keeps us in the game, because we may not tomorrow be able to produce those cars every 60 seconds. So I would just say it's about sizing and actually making sure that when we go offshore, we invest in the very best companies with a huge growth profile that we can possibly find anywhere in the world.
Akshay, and your point of view?
Sure. I think for me, what was most striking, meeting the fund managers and meeting some of the investment companies, is just the rigor and the depth of analysis that goes into the investment decision making. There is this obsession with meaningful alpha and not just creative beta, actually really understanding the drivers of value in the economy, understanding the emerging technology and making a play based on that. I met some managers who said, I interviewed the management team of this startup for 5 years before my first allocation. And since I've done that first allocation, I've made 7x my money in 2 years. And that is a commonplace story. It's a commonplace story in this VC market. There is an obsession with analysis. One of the most underrated elements of the Chinese economy is just how competitive it is. You have cities that are the size of countries in many cases, competing amongst each other for talent. You have VC funds who are multi-billion dollar funds competing against each other for the best investments. And the result of that competition is an exceptionally high output. And it's why we are so excited about backing the expertise here. Backing, an active management approach, but two, backing a diversified approach across fund managers. Because from what I've seen, these fund managers really do know what they're doing. And I think it's a lesson not only for South Africans, but it's a lesson for the entire world in the level at which this industry operates at.
As we've heard today, China's story isn't just about geopolitics or market cycles. It's about intention, coordination, and the willingness to think decades ahead. Whether you're advising pension funds, building portfolios, or investing privately, the opportunity lies in moving beyond headlines and looking at where the momentum is truly being built. A very special thank you to my guests, Akshay Karan and Jared Glansbeek, not only for the insights today, but also for allowing me the opportunity to experience China firsthand during our recent visit. Your generosity and perspective have made this episode possible. To all our CityWire South African listeners, thank you for joining me, Ruan Uester, for another episode of Money, Markets and Masterminds, and my producer, Andithio Novello, from the CityWire Studios team. If you find value in today's discussion, please subscribe, rate, and share the podcast. We're on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and iono.fm, and of course, citywire.co.za. There's a growing archive of interviews, videos, and articles waiting for you there too. And with that, and until next time, goodbye.